This is Monday, August 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Mellon in Washington. President Trump calls out specific groups for their part in a deadly protest. Also ahead, the top U.S. general is trying to deal with increased tensions and threats over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. And we examine the scientific research into the advantage of doing nothing at all, at least for a time. It's all on today's International Edition. Facing pressure from both sides of the aisle for him to explicitly condemn white supremacists and hate groups involved in deadly race-fueled clashes in Charlottesville, Virginia, President Donald Trump journeyed back from his vacation, a working vacation is what he calls it, while the White House is under renovation, to return to the White House. And just a few minutes ago, he came out with a statement that may placate some people. Here's what he said.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal. We are equal in the eyes of our Creator. We are equal under the law, and we are equal under our Constitution. Those who spread violence in the name of bigotry strike at the very core of America.
Let's check in now with VOA's Bill Gallo. He is at the White House. Bill, do you think this is going to stop all of the complaints, all of the retribution that the president was under for some of the comments he made right after the Charlottesville situation?
Well, I have a feeling that this comment will be welcomed. I don't know that all the criticism will stop, but I think that people will praise the fact that Trump specifically mentioned these groups, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists. He did add, and other hate groups, which I'm sure some people will take issue with, in some of the same sense, as he said the other day in his statement, the many sides comment that seemed to sort of make a lot of people angry and suggest there was some moral equivalence between neo-Nazis and the people who were there to protest the neo-Nazis. But overall, I think that this was a much tougher, specific condemnation, and I think a lot of people will be satisfied by that.
Well, for people who don't have a background of what is going on, there are some, in fact, quite a few in this country that say that President Trump does have the backing of this radical fringe, the right-wing fringe.
Right. And I mean, I think that to a degree is undeniable. You had a group of about 500 white supremacists. Some people call them white nationalists. They have different names. They were out there in Charlottesville from all over the country, and many of them were chanting pro-Trump type of slogans and wearing Make America Great Again hats. They were, in some cases, saying Hail Trump, things like that. So this group does support Trump. Now, to suggest that, Trump's base is made up of white supremacists, that's a whole other thing to say. But, yes, this is a group that does not only believe some of the same things as Trump, they differ with him on other things, but it just puts the president in an awkward situation, and it was a situation that he pretty obviously was hesitant to fully address, I think.
Yeah, I guess it puts him in a specific situation that he might not want to be in, but other people want to put him in. Now, one takes it that he didn't come back and break his working vacation in New Jersey and New York to come back to Washington just for this. So there are other things that are on the table today, right?
Right, yeah. At 3 o'clock Eastern time, Trump is expected to sign a memorandum on China trade issues, specifically on intellectual property. China, for a long time, has been accused of stealing into China's, the U.S., excuse me, China has been accused of stealing U.S. intellectual property. So Donald Trump is set to launch some sort of an investigation into that. Trump, of course, was very, very tough rhetorically on China during the campaign. He's backed off some of that in large part because he wants to get China's cooperation on North Korea. So it's not clear to what extent the things that he will announce today will actually put in place policies that are anywhere near as harsh as, you know, as he's talked about in the past.
Boy, he really is in a kind of a tenuous situation with China as far as North Korea is concerned, right?
Yeah, he really is. I mean, he needs their help. He knows he has to have their help. And, you know, they did sign on to the latest UN Security Council resolution. And as the newscast mentioned earlier, just before this interview, China has announced a bit more of a crackdown on North Korean imports. So they are taking some steps. I don't know if it will be enough to keep the White House happy and to keep Trump happy. I guess we'll just see.
Bill Gallo, William Gallo, VOA at the White House. And Bill, I thank you for putting up with what has been a very busy day for you to be with us here on International Edition. Take care, Bill. All right, let's join Andrew Palczewski, who joins me in the studio here to talk about this and other things in social media.
Yeah, well, this has obviously been a big topic of conversation on social media. One thing I've been struck by in the past couple days is how people are using social media and digital media to fight back against the racism, against all of the terrible things that are happening in Charlottesville. And so we start with two esteemed members of the United States Congress, one Democrat, one Republican, one currently serving and one retired. Both of them use Twitter to get a big message out about this and a big reaction. First, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, a Republican, he tweeted out through his Senate office, "We should call every evil by its name. My brother didn't give his life fighting for Hitler or fighting Hitler for Nazi ideas to go unchallenged here at home." That tweet getting more than 46,000 retweets and more than 138,000 likes. And then you have John Dingell, a former congressman from Michigan. He tweeted out, "I signed up to fight Nazis 73 years ago, and I'll do it again if I have to. Hatred, bigotry, and fascism should have no place in this country." That got more than 265,000 retweets and more than 760,000 likes. So these two men who are in well in their 80s and 90s, perhaps not the age group that you'd associate with using digital media, are using this here and sending out a big message, and it's getting a big response. We also have the web service GoDaddy.com, known for its salacious Super Bowl ads. They've announced that they're going to pull a white supremacist website from their web service after it had some controversial content. And then Twitter users are actually using photos of the people at these rallies, these white supremacists, to find and identify them. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, whether that's going to incite more violence, remains to be seen. But all these instances, people are taking this in their own hands on social media and trying to do good.
Andrew Palczewski with a look at social media. Thanks so much, Andrew. Talk again tomorrow. Among the top stories in the world, President Donald Trump calls out white supremacists for their part in a deadly procession and a protest in Charlottesville, Virginia. Tension on the Korean Peninsula eased slightly today as South Korea's president said resolving North Korea's nuclear ambitions must be done peacefully, and U.S. officials play down the risk of an imminent war. The U.S. vice president says the United States will not stand by while Venezuela collapses into dictatorship. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta Monday appealed to the opposition to hold legal demonstrations and not street protest and allow Kenyans to get back to normal life after last week's disputed vote. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our social media platforms. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers led by the UK's University of Hertfordshire say they have found four Earth-like planets orbiting the closest sun-like star. Two of the four are located in the habitable or Goldilocks zone, an orbital region around its sun where it is not too hot nor too cold and where liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. The team says each of the planets, which have a mass of about 70% more than Earth, are circling Tau Ceti, a star located about 12 light-years away in the Cetus constellation. If the two planets initially identified as habitable could actually support life, the astronomers suggest Tau Ceti could make an ideal destination for interstellar colonization. The downside, however, is the star is surrounded by a huge debris disk, which could reduce the habitability of the planets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you, Rick. VOA's International Edition continues now. The United States top general arrived on the Korean Peninsula amid unprecedented threats between Washington and Pyongyang. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with General Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and she reports from Osan Air Base in South Korea.
U.S. General Joe Dunford told reporters en route to Korea that the U.S. military's primary focus is supporting the administration's diplomatic and economic campaign to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. But he said he's also drawing up attack plans.
As a military leader, I've got to make sure that the president does have viable military options in the event the diplomatic and economic pressurization campaign fails.
Upon his arrival at Osan Air Base, Dunford wasted no time speaking with top commanders to gauge the temperature in the region. North Korea has made big gains in its nuclear weapons development through several missile tests this year. Pyongyang now says it has a nuclear missile capable of reaching the United States. Carla Babb, VOA News, Osan Air Base, South Korea.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, at the start of a four-nation Latin American trip, stressed yesterday during a stop in Colombia that a peaceful solution to the political, social, and economic crisis in Venezuela is still possible between the opposition and socialist President Nicolas Maduro.
The Maduro regime has ignored and undermined its National Assembly. It's stifled the voices of a free press and the masses alike, and imprisoned countless political opponents. And more than 130 brave Venezuelans have already died in the desperate fight for democracy. The United States, Colombia, and free nations of Latin America will not be silent. Venezuela is sliding into dictatorship. And as President Trump has said, the United States will not stand by as Venezuela crumbles. We will continue to stand with free nations across our hemisphere until democracy is restored for the Venezuelan people. As President Trump said just a few days ago, we have many options for Venezuela. But the president also remains confident that working with all of our allies across Latin America, we can achieve a peaceable solution to the crisis facing the Venezuelan people.
Those comments that the vice president was talking about followed those made Friday by President Trump, who said the U.S. would not rule out a military option as Mr. Maduro attempts to consolidate power. However, Rice University's Joseph Jamail, the chair of the Latin American Studies section there, Mark Jones, told VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Trump's remarks were neither helpful nor realistic.
The United States has no realistic plan nor desire to get involved in an internal conflict in Venezuela. And all the president has done there is create sympathy for President Maduro in Venezuela and force the rest of Latin America, who agrees that things need to change in Venezuela, in some ways at least, shift away from the United States. Really, the United States should be doing the opposite. That is highlighting the tragedy that the Maduro regime is inflicting on the Venezuelan population.
Well, the director of Central Intelligence appearing on U.S. television Sunday, Mike Pompeo, said the comment by the president raising the possibility of possible military action was, quote, to give the Venezuelan people hope and opportunity to create a situation where democracy can be restored.
That is Mr. Pompeo or Director Pompeo trying to make the best of a bad situation. I think it's simply the president behaving in an unpresidential and irresponsible way, in doing so harming U.S. foreign policy.
What can the U.S. do?
Well, there's really very little the United States can do with Venezuela at this point in time. First, we are not seen as a neutral actor in Venezuela. We're seen as clearly supporting the opposition. And in the rest of Latin America, there's a great deal of reticence for the U.S. to get involved in anything, given the long history of U.S. intervention in the 50s, the 60s, and 70s. At the same time, the only real solution to Venezuela's problems can come from within Venezuela. And so the United States needs to support efforts to effectively return democracy to Venezuela. But it would be far better if that was to come through the efforts of other Latin American countries, not the United States. So I think the productive things can be what Vice President Pence is doing right now, that is meeting with President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, meeting with President Mauricio Macri in Argentina, and getting their assistance in helping to coordinate a Latin American effort to try to engage the Venezuelan population and both sides, both the Chavista side of President Maduro and the opposition, to come to some type of consensus to pull Venezuela out of the political, economic, and social hole in which it's increasingly falling, because the country is facing increasing violence, but also within a economic and social context where people are dying of hunger and of very simple medical problems. And if something's not done soon, we're going to see the country, I think, descend further into chaos and collapse.
And that, Mark Jones warned, could result in a refugee problem for countries like Colombia and economic distress in the United States, where Venezuelan oil exports help keep gasoline prices low. This is VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Today's culture values keeping busy and multitasking. Not only adults, but children and teenagers as well have become busier than ever. However, neurologists and psychologists say keeping kids constantly learning and practicing, even during the summer vacation, is not good for them. What do we do instead? Allow them to goof off. Faiza El-Masri has the story, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
Helping children succeed and thrive is one of the issues psychologist Lee Waters has been researching for two decades. In her book, The Strength Switch, she suggests that parents focus on building up their child's strengths rather than fixing their weaknesses.
In working with parents all around the world on this strength-based parenting approach, one of the common questions that I get asked is, okay, so once I've identified the strengths in my children, what do I need to do to build up those strengths? And in that question, there's often a kind of misconception that as a parent, the way that we build up our children's strengths is to get them into extra tutoring, get them into kind of every class possible.
The result is often an overcrowded schedule, keeping kids' brains constantly busy learning, gathering information, and practicing.
Yes, practice builds up strengths, but so does downtime. One of the counterintuitives that we're finding in the field of neuroscience is that if you're constantly on task, if you're constantly practicing, in the end, it doesn't help to build up a skill or a strength as effectively as you might think.
Waters' book is mainly based on her own research, but she also cites a variety of studies by other researchers.
Some of my favorite researchers that I mentioned in the book are people like Dina Weisberg and her colleagues at Columbia University, who have done a lot of work on what happens to students' abilities to think and their well-being when we deliberately bring play back into the school environment. I love Kathy Hirsch-Pasek's research at Temple University on not overstructuring your kids. She's really influenced the way I parent personally. I love Mary Helen Amorto-Yang's research. She's a professor of education, psychology, and neuroscience at the University of Southern California. And she's done a lot of work on the idea that our brains have these two alternative systems.
Those two brain modes or networks are on-task focus and free-form attention. Immorto Yang says the on-task focus is about perceiving one's environment, watching, and paying attention. That happens when you play sports, for example.
You need to be watching other people on your team and running fast and coordinating your motions and reacting to the things that you're perceiving. And then there is another network that's extremely important for being able to make meaning out of what you're doing. And that network seems to be deactivated when people are, you know, sort of playing sports and attending to the outside. And it's activated when you're resting and just daydreaming, when you're thinking about your memories and imagining things that don't actually exist here and now. You need those two modes of attention in order to function as a person in the world.
Psychologist Waters says slowing down actually helps kids reach their full potential.
It's a little bit like if you have too many programs running on your computer starts to slow down. And when you shut down those programs, your computer speeds up again. It's very much like that for a child's brain.
Machines need to reboot, and kids need to goof off.
What I mean by goofing off is really allowing kids to have some downtime where they're not focused on a specific task, something that they choose to do, like shooting baskets or, you know, doing a creative project, cooking. It's a project that they're interested in doing that they can do more automatically and they get enjoyment from.
Goofing off doesn't mean the brain becomes inactive.
It goes into this default network mode and it uses that time to process all of the information it's had during the day, to integrate new information. It makes a kind of decision about what information do I keep and put into my memory, what information do I not need and I get rid of. It's also an essential network for helping us to develop emotional intelligence, to consolidate our memory, to develop a sense of identity.
Psychologist and book author Lee Waters says she hopes parents will be convinced that children don't have to be busy all the time, that they'll give their kids and themselves permission to goof off every now and then. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Just some updates on stories that we have for you. Gunmen attacked a United Nations peacekeeping base in Mali's northern city of Timbuktu on Monday. The peacekeeping mission said that, adding that it had deployed a rapid response force with helicopters to the scene. A spokeswoman for the UN peacekeeping mission said by telephone that an attack has been launched against one of our camps in Timbuktu by unknown men with machine guns. Sporadic gunfire was continuing, she said. We will be following that for you throughout the day. And Vice President Mike Pence says that the U.S. is absolutely determined to bring full measure of U.S. economic, diplomatic power to bear until democracy is restored in Venezuela. That is going to wrap up our program for today. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us on voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks to our director, Kwame Afori, our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For much of its brief existence, South Sudan has been mired in a civil war, a conflict that has killed tens of thousands of people and forced some 4 million to flee their homes, creating Africa's worst refugee crisis since the 1994 Rwandan genocide. A 2015 peace agreement and a transitional government formed in early 2016 failed to end the violence. In late May of this year, President Salva Kiir declared a unilateral government ceasefire and promised a release of political prisoners. But no prisoners have been released, and despite the ceasefire, heavy fighting has been reported in parts of the country, according to the UN. This is particularly true of the opposition stronghold near the town of Pagak in Upper Nile State. On July 24th, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, an 8-country regional development organization in East Africa that has been trying to mediate the situation in South Sudan, announced that it will convene a forum to revitalize implementation of the 2015 peace agreement. In late July, Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States, known as the Troika in the context of the South Sudan peace effort, as well as the European Union, issued a statement condemning the continued violence in South Sudan. The PAGAC offensive is a clear violation of the unilateral ceasefire declared by President Salva Kiir and calls into question the government's commitment to reach peace through the national dialogue. The statement welcomed the IGAD decision to revitalize the South Sudan peace process. The proliferation of violence, displacement, and food insecurity renders any discussion of elections in the foreseeable future as an unnecessary diversion from the primary goals of achieving peace and reconciliation, said the Troika statement. South Sudan's leaders, neighbors, and regional and international partners must first focus on achieving peace in order to create the conditions needed to hold credible elections. To achieve these urgent goals, we look forward to the prompt revitalization of an inclusive and credible peace process by IGAD.